This is Sound Effect. I'm Kevin Kniestad, and this is our annual music show where we give a listen to our favorite music stories from the past 12 months. Now, if you are a hardcore Sound Effect fan, you might know that it is a tradition for us to do our annual music show on Thanksgiving weekend. So why are we doing this a month early? Well, there's a reason for that, and you are definitely going to want to know what that reason is. But I'm going to wait until the end of the show to tell you what that is. So be sure to hang around for the whole show so I can fill you in on some pretty important information. In the meantime, let's get to the music, starting with a conversation Gabriel Spitzer had with Rachel Ratner last year via Skype.
I was in a band called Part Man, Part Horse, and that's where the idea started. I remember I was talking to one of my friends about my band and how I was able to, through other people I play music with, connect my band to my friends' bands, and we started kind of diagramming them out like a 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon kind of a thing, just to see like how we were all connected. And then I started like getting more and more obsessed with the idea, and so then I had these like legal pads with like band names kind of scrawled on them connecting to each other, and pretty soon I had a couple hundred just like local bands all through shared band members. I thought it was like pretty neat.
These days Rachel is in a band called Wimps. She's also a software engineer and a brand new mother. You might hear a little Hazel in the background there. But most importantly for our purposes, Rachel is the creator of the Seattle Band Map.
I showed it to my friend Keith Whiteman, who is an artist, and he thought it would be neat to make it into an actual art show, like an art project. So he took it, my little paper-sized map, and he blew it up huge. He made it, it was like 10 feet by 10 feet. So we invited people down. This was in November of 2009. Both to come view it and to come add to it. It became a really neat interactive kind of art show where just over that weekend, like 600 new bands were added, and it was really exciting to see because you would sit back and you would watch people looking at the map together, and then they started talking to each other about those bands and maybe reminiscing about shows they'd been to together or reminding each other about things they'd forgotten. So it really kind of brought people together.
With hundreds of people adding their bands to the map with Sharpies, the 10 by 10 sheet of vinyl started getting quite crowded. So in 2011, Rachel took the Seattle Band Map online.
It's pretty sparse. It's like a kind of a white page. And then in the middle, there's like the map, which is just a million tiny points, little lines between them, kind of zoomed out like a constellation. And so you can see all these points, which are bands. And then as you click on one or you zoom in, it brings up the band name, who's in it, and like who it's connected to.
So have you discovered any fun kind of 6 degrees of separation relationships among bands that you could relay?
Yeah. Taco Cat's a band that's been playing quite a lot recently. And kind of going through it, I was able to connect them all the way back to Green Day, which is a much larger band that's also a punk band. That's one of their influences. So it's kind of neat to see how they could actually be connected to a band that influenced them.
Oh, interesting. So their lineage through again, humans, they yeah, actually do have connection to them.
Which they didn't realize. So like one of their members played in a band who was connected to a band called Simi River. Who was connected to a band called Duchess of the Duke. Who was connected to a band called The Intelligence. And through that, there was a connection to The Shins, who are much larger. And through The Shins, there was a connection to Modest Mouse. There was a connection to a band called Jawbreaker. And through that, there was a connection to Green Day. So they were able to go, even though they themselves didn't know anybody in Green Day, through the 6 degrees of separation, they were able to be connected back to one of their influences. So I thought that was pretty neat. I think it was just eye-opening to see how everyone's related and how we're all kind of doing the same thing. But when I look at this, I look at this more like times in my life, people I knew, friendships I've had, you know, because I'm like, oh, I'm connected to Part Man, Part Horse, and I'm still friends with Gary and Lisa and Marshall in that band, and they just came over and met my daughter. So it's kind of like these are connections, but these are also like, you know, friendships and people in my life. I think I'm just going to keep it around as long as people are interested in it. People still seem to want to look at it and ask about it, and I'm still getting people adding bands to it all the time. So it's still kind of a living thing. So I think it doesn't have an end right now.
The map has over 6,000 bands on it at last count. It's still morphing and evolving, just like the musicians who use it to chart their own journeys from one band to the next.
So if life is a journey, then, well, you know the ultimate destination. And getting there to the end of life is often not pretty. The sheer physicality of aging and dying are things we try not to think about, so it's especially striking when these subjects turn up in unexpected places, say, your indie rock playlist. Carrie Goodwin plays bass for the Seattle-based band Great Grandpa, and she also happens to be a nursing student. In her song Rosalie, Goodwin introduces us to someone losing her grip on life and maybe gets us a little closer to wrapping our brains around our common fate. She caught up with sound effect contributor Allie Ferguson to dissect the song and talk about the intersection of nursing and art.
The path in her brain gets rewarded again, where it hardens and strengthens.
So when I was in college working as a nursing assistant, I would get lots of different kinds of patients. A lot of them had dementia, and one patient I had whose name was not actually Rosalie, and I changed it for a HIPAA violation, but she was in her 80s and she had pretty advanced dementia to the point where her behavior was very strange, and I just found it really difficult to be with someone who didn't really seem like a person anymore but was still alive.
There's an endless expanding drawn in the eyes, a soul decomposing, a body alive.
One thing that I am very proud of about Rosalie is the song structure of how the story develops. You sort of get introduced to her in a very vague way in the introduction, and then the first verse you sort of see her as she is, and the second verse you see her as she was, and then the end is sort of trying to make sense of what's all happening. And it very much mirrored my experience of you first show up and you're sort of brought into this very strange world. It takes you a while to get comfortable with what they're doing and who they are and sort of what their reality is, and then your mind sort of wanders and you think about what they used to be, and then you leave and you have to make sense and integrate back into your own life and face your own future of uncertainty. One of the most interesting things is the line about cereal on the ceiling. I gave her a bowl of dry cereal as a snack, and so she was eating it, and then all of a sudden she just threw it against the wall and then looked at me very seriously, and she's like, "I'm done." And it was just something, I mean, it was almost something that a toddler would do, and it just really took me off guard, and also it was so funny. And, you know, you have a brief moment of humor in a really difficult day, and that was why that was inspired by.
Yeah, in dealing with people with dementia, there can be a lot of difficult and funny and strange moments all throughout the day. How do you deal with that as a caregiver? It's almost like you kind of have to adapt to their reality.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like your first instinct when somebody has dementia and expresses very strange concerns or fears is to try and reorient them, try to bring them back into your reality. But actually, it's much better to just sort of go with their reality. It creates less trauma for them to not have to constantly be yanked back in and out of their worlds. Rosalie in particular was very paranoid. She would often say things like, "Please don't hurt me." you know, and as a caregiver, you're like, well, I would never hurt you. And I don't know if anything had happened to her in her past that she had been hurt. I kind of suspect not. And paranoia is really common in that. But just that was hard as a caregiver to have someone fear you in that way and have it be totally unfounded in that case.
Rose Lee lives on her own, scared like a German shepherd in the back of the yard.
Yeah, I guess the imagery is sort of like a dog that is alarming and protective and scared of something that doesn't really make sense. You know, it's sort of almost an instinct to be defensive, and but you're being defensive by also being aggressive.
I feel like the song really builds, and then there's this anthemic release, especially vocally for Alex, the lead singer. Why did you make that choice in the songwriting?
After you spend an entire day with someone who has dementia, I would always leave those places and feel, because you almost feel like you get sort of stuck on their world and on their pace. Everything's slow. Everything is very repetitive. And then I would sort of leave their house and just have this moment of freedom and like feeling being in a young body and sort of moving quickly. Sometimes I would even run or just like have this moment of, I'm not there yet, you know, because I think a lot of it is, when you're exposed to that all the time, you sort of feel like it's inevitable for yourself and you start reflecting a lot on your own mortality. And so I think the end of the song for me was a way to sort of break free from it a little bit and remember that we're still young and full of life.
The word relentless is so key in that, because there's no real recovery or healing for dementia. Why did you choose that word specifically?
I think a lot of it is that life just felt so unfair at times. That's sort of what relentless meant to me, is it just life kind of takes things from you one at a time, and that's one of the only things that's for sure in our life. And I think that was really hard for me to deal with. It still is. I haven't made a lot of progress there.
But now, I mean, you're going to be a nurse pretty soon, and now having this training, has that changed how you approach that or think about that at all?
Yeah, I've always had many fears, and I've also always really tried to confront my fears, so I think that's maybe why, as a child who was particularly afraid of death, I ended up focusing so much on care of the elderly, and now I've been around several people as they're passing, and I was getting very stuck on the relentless and, you know, fixed nature of that sort of thing. And I think I've only recently, through these experiences, learned to sort of reframe it a little bit. Like, yes, you can't help that this is happening, but that also gives you a lot of freedom in the way that you think about it. And you can think about death as being, you know, something that can be really beautiful. And I think it's only by being exposed to it over and over again and seeing the different kinds of ways that people can leave this world, and you realize that there are much better ways than others.
You don't see medicine necessarily represented in music a whole lot. What does it mean to you to have this outlet as you start your nursing career?
Nurses see so much tragic stuff every single day. It's just a part of the job, as you see people on the worst days of their lives. And so I think developing good ways to process and cope with that is really important for anyone who works in patient care, but especially nurses who are involved in the minutia of these people's lives every single day. Most of us are drawn to this profession because we care about people and because we're empathetic people, but that can become a liability over time because you absorb everyone's pain and then you sort of burn out. And I think that's very common. So I guess my goal is hopefully that I can use music or other forms of creativity as a way to process it, make some sense out of it, and maybe make something beautiful out of it. I guess I just have to make sure that I don't write too many sad songs about my patients.
That story was produced by sound effect contributor Allie Ferguson. Thank you. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Kevin Kniestead, and this is our sixth annual music show, where we give a listen to our stories about music from the past year. We head back in time now to the early 1980s and some of the most forgettable Seattle Mariners seasons ever. The team was bad, but while the M's were posting losing records, one particular player was releasing a pretty good record. Sound Effect contributor Hans Anderson tells the story of how a baseball strike led one Mariner to become the new musical version of himself he always wanted to be.
Growing up going to Mariners games, there were a few replays I remember seeing highlighted on the Jumbotron pretty much every time I went to the Kingdome. There's the 95 slide, which sent the Mariners to the American League Championship Series. There's a grand slam by Edgar Martinez from one game before the 95 slide. And then there's a hit by Amos Otis of the Kansas City Royals on May 27th, 1981.
Otis, right-handed hitter against reliever Larry Anderson.
In the video, Otis hits a little dribbler down the third base line. Seattle infielder Lenny Randle drops to his hands and knees and, by nearly every account except his own, blows the ball out of bounds. Blowing on the ball is deemed player interference. Otis advances to first, which Randle takes some issue with.
Randle cannot get down and influence.
Your eyes are not always what you see, you know what I'm saying? If I yelled at the ball and the ball continued to go the way away from my breath as I'm yelling, I wouldn't call that blowing, I would call it yelling. And I yell so strong, there was like an earthquake, like a volcano erupting. Because when I get mad, I really get mad. I mean, it's like hot sauce. So the ball went foul.
You heard that right. Lenny Randle is saying that he yelled the ball out of bounds. This highlight stands out in a mediocre season in a series of other mediocre seasons by a mediocre baseball team. But it wasn't the only contribution made to Seattle by Randle. In his 2 years as a Mariner, his personality made him a sports icon here. Fans would write letters to the Seattle Times praising him. There are newspaper reports that he almost became an announcer for the Supersonics. And most importantly for this story, he wrote what I feel is a really good funk song about the Kingdome. Randle's musical history starts back in his home of Compton, California.
Our families on Sundays would dress up like the Jacksons or the Huxtables or the Ozzie and Ricky Nelson because we thought we were musicians and artists and singers. So all our uncles, and my grandmother had 13 kids, so do the math times nine. That's where I stopped doing the math. I couldn't keep up. So I have a lot of siblings that thought we were the Temptations, the Supremes, the Four Tops. You name a group, and we thought we were, or we'd do the impressions on Sunday after church. Because we thought, oh, wow, we got this. We sound pretty good. At least we thought we sound good.
Randle felt that he would become a musician after he went to school. Clearly, he was good at baseball, though, and was drafted by the Washington Senators. He bounced around to a few different teams, had a pretty good year with the Mets in 77, and then landed on the Seattle Mariners, where he played in that monolithic concrete structure, the Kingdome. He was enamored with it. He was even interested in the pronunciation of the thing.
Well, there's two versions of that. One, first, when some people say kingdom with the E at the end, kingdom, and some say kingdom. So it depends on your culture, if you're from Jerusalem, Italy, or South Central. So, and if from Seattle, kingdom. Everybody said, we're going to go to the kingdom to watch a game, because that was a big thing to watch David Craig and all the larger catch passes when the Seahawks were there. So when the Mariners came in, we're the new Mariners, I said, God, this king, you mean we're going to play? We're not going to get rained out? This is the kingdom. Everybody said, say kingdom.
But let's back up a bit. Before Kingdom was a recorded song, it was just a joke between some players during batting practice. Somewhat memorable early Mariners like Julio Cruz and Dave Henderson were with Randle.
We're around the batting cage hitting, and I said, Kingdom, and David Henderson said, now when you're in the Kingdom, you got to check out the AstroTurf. Now check out the turf, and Dave, I said, Dave, that's a song, bro.
And then came the 1981 player strike, which put the baseball season on hold and gave Randle the opportunity he'd been waiting for.
Good evening, fans. The national pastime, which for the last 50 days has been a national pain in the neck.
Our payroll stopped. Do you understand that when there's a strike, you don't get paid? So where's your alternative? Food stamps? Stay on the line with a can? Perform? Ask for charity? Sell your house and car?
All of a sudden, there were 40 unemployed athletes in Seattle who had lots of free time, a song about the kingdom, and who needed a little extra money. Randall finally had an opportunity to be the performer he had wanted to be in his childhood. He organized shows at clubs in Seattle initially, and eventually at the Moore Theater. The centerpiece of these shows was Randall and a handful of other Mariners performing the song Kingdom. It even had an accompanying dance where you put your hands over your head in an arc and mimic running around the bases. The Seattle Times said of the show, quote, "The joint was jumping," end quote. Some of the shows were benefits, one to buy a voice synthesizer for a young Mariners fan with cerebral palsy. Other shows benefited players, with Randall paying his teammates a couple $100.
And now, I'm not Bank of America, but at least you can get some groceries.
The player strike ended, but by that time, Randall had gone down to California to record the song with his brother and his 10-year-old niece. They also recorded a song for the B-side of that EP, a sultry jam filled with baseball puns called I'm a Ball Player. Randall was cut by the Mariners in 1982 and left Seattle to play professionally in Italy. His recording of Kingdom gained a little bit more popularity after it was reissued on Weedle's Groove Volume 2, a compilation of Seattle soul and funk. Regardless, Randall certainly left his mark on the city, not for his mediocre .231 batting average, necessarily, but for being a character, which fits into Randall's life philosophy.
We're entertainers for life, whether we like it or not. We are entertainers for life, so we're supposed to do something. It's a calling for us to do what we do, make people happy. Give scholarships, give what you have back, because most of us don't need the money. We just need another opportunity to make people's lives better, and that's what the calling is.
At 70, Randall is doing pretty well, but the kingdom, not so much. It never made it to see the age of 25.
I hate they tore it down. We're still crying. Every time we see it, there's a guy named DJ Assassin in Seattle. They always send me the video of the last day of the kingdom. And I'm going, my song died with the destruction of the kingdom.
Randall may be a bit too hard on himself. The dome may be gone, but Randall and his funky ode to the former Seattle landmark live on.
That story from contributor Hans Anderson. This is Sound Effect. I'm Kevin Kniestead, and this is our annual music show. At first glance, hidden is not the word you'd use for Chance McKinney's talents. As an athlete in high school and college, he got plenty of recognition.
I got a track scholarship to Third Ave and went to a Pac-12 school. And I mean, I kept qualifying for the Olympic trials.
But this very capable guy had a whole other set of gifts that weren't so obvious. They emerged years later when he was teaching high school math in Mukilteo. On a whim, he'd submitted an original song to a music contest. And somehow, to his shock, McKinney's country song blew up.
I'm sitting there in a math class with ABC television and radio stations and newspapers and everybody and my kids, you know, from that class, finding out that I had a number one on CMT. I had no band, no nothing. It was just, here I am, Chance McKinney. Number one unsigned singer-songwriter. I'll always
be real. Chance is now a successful full-time country musician, but his motivation to achieve both in sports and in music comes largely from being bullied as a child.
You know, it's strange to sit in the same room with me. You would think that I never got bullied. I'm a little bigger than everybody else and always have been. But, you know, my dad told me that the only time you ever fight is when you get backed into a corner. And he said, if you do, then I'll handle it when you get home. So I'd just kind of grown up being a jovial, big kid, and a couple kids moved into school and in middle school, and looking back at it now, I kind of understand why they bullied me, because they grew up in not such good households. I didn't understand at the time, for sure, but I was loved at home, and I don't know how much they were. And that, you know, when you got a big target like I was, every kid wants to establish their dominance on the playground, and so, you know, when you got a problem with two or three kids and they're always coming after you, it kind of got to be the thing there for about 2 or 3 years. I mean, it messed with my self-esteem. I mean, I went home and I cried on the couch downstairs every day. My folks would walk in and be like, what happened today? And, you know, some days I'd tell them, some days I wouldn't. And it just felt like constant mosquitoes, constant verbal torture. I never fought back. And I don't know why, but then my dad would turn that around and we'd be heading to a baseball game, or we'd be heading, I pitched all through, you know, middle school, and, you know, we'd be on our way to a game and he's like, you still worrying about school today? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, well, go ahead and take that out on the players you're going up against. And, I mean, I had games where I'd strike out the entire team, you know. We'd go, you know, a 6-inning game or a 7-inning game, and I'd end up with 20 strikeouts. There was a method to his madness. I still got bullied a little bit in high school. It was always, you know, people kind of found out I was an easier target or wouldn't fight back. But I do remember... I do remember being on, you know, teams where those kids who were picking on me in social life could not make the team. And I would tell my dad, oh, so-and-so, you know, pushed me around the halls today, but he got cut from the basketball team. And he's like, how's that make you feel? And I said, pretty damn good. And he goes, me too. And I took that approach, you know, to unleash the pent-up frustration that I had in athletics. Life was athletics, man. I mean, it was one sport to the next. And this kind of, as my athletic career started to wind up, I needed an outlet. And I got turned on to music, and that's my new sport. And so I record a really terrible first CD. Get an appointment with Becky Brenner. Becky was the senior most woman in CBS radio for, I don't know, 40 years. So I get an appointment with KMPS, which happened to be the 7th largest country station in the nation at the time. And I have no representation, no nothing. I'm just 2 years out of college and here we go. I've got a CD. I'm going to get this on the radio. So I walk in. She takes the meeting with me. I have no idea why. And she sits across the desk and she throws it in. She's listening maybe 13 seconds of each song, maybe 22 at the best. She takes it out, puts it back in the case, throws it across the desk and goes, this is really bad. And I went, well, it's 9 of my first 13 songs. And she goes, dear God, never play that for anyone. And I went, I'll get better. And she goes, I hope so. And so she continued to so eloquently berate me right there. And I just kind of sat there and took it. And I said, I'll get better. And it wasn't 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks later, she called me and asked me to open for Kenny Chesney. That was my very first country concert. Say hello, Faye.
a smile. How you been? Been a while. Stop reading my mind, girl. Just like,
you know, she opened up a lot of doors for me. I was, I think, my fourth show. I was opening Maid Stage for Shadazy. We did shows with Kenny Chesney, Rascal Flatts, Toby Keith, Brooks and Dunn, Jason Aldean. That was the new sport. You know, this was my outlet. This was something for me to compete at. And so I started flying down to Nashville and writing with, you know, exceptional writers and learning the craft and, you know, taking singing lessons and learning to play guitar. And it was like, it all happened so fast when those opportunities came.
Said some things we don't mean, second thoughts in between. Now and then got us right here.
You got to understand that, you know, I think my biggest year was I did 120 some shows. And then I took 104 flights that year. But I've always told people that 90% of the shows you're up for are no's. I don't know if I took offense to any of that, but definitely my past, dealing with, you know, middle schoolers and being an athlete played a part in. I don't know if I did part of it to spite people, or if I just to prove them wrong, or to prove myself that I could do it. I still, to this day, I don't see myself in the mirror as anything but a 6th, 7th, or 8th grader. That time period is entrenched in my life. I still get no's, and I still have plenty of doubters. And I'm just trying to make them wrong, and all the people who do believe in me, right.
Are you a... 3 little words on my screen, but it's so much more when I read in between all the lines. How many times will I let you in, let you mess with my mind? It's like you've got a sixth sense, you always seem to know when I'm home all alone. I should tell you I won't, but I don't. I can call you my ex and every name. Can't call you quits.
You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Kevin Kniestead, and this is our 6th annual music show where we listen back to our favorite music stories from the past 12 months. Plenty of artists look to past struggles when they're creating. It's why there are so many songs about heartbreak and disappointment. Seattle rapper Porter Ray Sullivan, who goes by Porter Ray on stage, has used music to cope with and process a whole string of setbacks in his life and somehow emerge with hope. Just a heads up, this segment contains some adult language and subject matter. When Porter Ray gets to the radio station, he's got his 8-year-old son Aaron with him in tow. Aaron's a little shy when he's asked if he wants to sit in the studio with us during our chat, but that shyness dissolves quickly when he leaves the studio and makes faces at me through the studio window while I talk to his dad. Porter Ray is 31 years old, but looks young enough to be his son's older brother, and certainly too young to have gone through what he's gone through. But as a musician, he's made his splash.
My early childhood was good. It was love. I had both of my parents around. My parents were together. My mom's is a black woman. My father is a white man. But both of our families always came together on holidays and birthdays. My dad was a lawyer in my early life. And my mom was an educator and working in early education and academics. And so we always had food on the table. We grew up in a nice house. I grew up in Capitol Hill. I grew up, with a lot of friends on my block and friends in my neighborhood, and could, you know, walk anywhere in my neighborhood, ride my bike. But my early life before high school, all through middle school, was good, man. It was a beautiful time.
Porter Ray was a talented basketball player, and music was around too. His parents were avid vinyl collectors, and he would always watch and record music videos off the television and songs off the radio. But when he was an early teenager, his family started to notice some issues with his father's health.
We were riding in the car, and he ran a red light or something like that. And kind of, I think he might have stopped in the intersection, and we were being honked at on both sides. And he wouldn't go forward. And it, you know, and I'm asking him what's going on, and he's getting real frustrated with me. But he just wouldn't punch the gas, and so we were kind of stuck.
Porter Ray's dad was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and over the next 4 years, his health deteriorated rapidly. He passed away when Porter Ray was 16.
And it was a huge reason that I started, hanging out in the streets and you know, trying to hustle and being distracted from school and losing interest in school and losing interest in athletics, too, you know, just trying to find my place as a young man in the world, but feeling, you know, like I was an adult.
Porter Ray says that when his dad passed away, it was like losing his only role model. He eventually dropped out of high school and started hanging out with friends who were getting themselves in a little trouble. He'd find different ways to try and make money so he could help put food on the table or buy clothes for his little brother and sister. And while there were plenty of struggles, he said the passing of his father made him more philosophical and reflective. And that, in turn, led to his desire to express himself artistically.
And so it just had to come out somehow.
Back then, back before my pops got sick, that's when the plot got thick. Started fiending for some drop time. Back then, I used to just chill out, sit back, work on my handles, pull the pill out. Now mama's saying, please leave them hoes alone, stop talking.
Can you talk to me about what happened on July 22nd, 2009?
July 22nd, 2009, my brother was murdered in Leschi in a what was like a dispute between his friend and this other kid. And it was him showing up, I guess, kind of as support for his friend. And that resulted in my brother being shot. I want to say accidentally. I believe there was only one shot that was taken from the house, and my brother ended up being murdered that day, 18 years old. Aaron, that's my brother, Aaron John. But yeah, that's the day my little brother passed.
Porter Ray has shared this story before, but sitting in the studio with him, you can see it on his face that this still isn't easy.
It messed me up. It f***ed me up. You know, when my father passed, I knew it was coming, and so it was still very tough, and it was extremely painful. But when my brother was killed, you know, he was just shot dead. You know, it was instant. And so there was nothing that could prepare me for that. And man, my brother is my best friend. And I mean, man, someone that I actually looked up to a lot. You know, he was a very strong individual and just an ill dude. And he was really coming into his own. Man, it was at a time when a lot of my friends were getting locked up. A lot of my friends were getting money but got into difficult situations. Just a lot of things around me were crumbling. But it also, too, it really fueled my art and me having a passion for rhyme. And that's what kind of really, really motivated me and inspired me to really start recording music seriously.
He was 21 years old when his brother was murdered and processing all of this. Writing about it helped, but telling his story through music means having to constantly revisit it.
Like especially when I was writing my album and I was trying to make it personal, it was tough to relive a lot of these moments and try to capture those moments or express my feelings about it and having to look inside of myself and how I really feel about things and things that I'm hurt by, things that I'm traumatized by. And trying to recapture those, it's difficult to create it. But on the back end, when the final product is there, you know, when I hear it, when I'm listening to it, if I'm playing, then it's almost this release, and it's good. It's good for me.
Porter Ray was introduced to Jeff Gillis, a veteran in the music industry, who became his manager. Together, they started going through Porter Ray's huge library of music and put out a trio of mixtapes in 2013. Porter Ray signed with Sub Pop Records in 2014, and 3 years later, he released his long-awaited breakthrough album called Watercolor.
I just wanted people to soak it up and to love it and just run it, you know what I mean? And something that would be hopefully timeless, and that would, again, I could capture a moment in time for my city and for my story and just have it be this imprint.
New crops, new clones. Aaron John had to put your name in my new song. 1-4-11-9-91. Murdered on July 22nd. Let me light my blunt. I can't front me up mentally. Sometimes I wish that your bullet had been meant for me. I hit my tree and pretend that you're still here.
Watercolor was extremely well received, and Porter Ray was set to go on tour. But 1 week after the album was released, tragedy struck again.
The week after that, my son's mother, Joy Brandon, passed away in a car accident, and I was on tour. I met her in high school, and we instantly kind of hit it off and became really, really good friends. And ended up parenting together, and you know, this again, yeah, someone who's, you know, who's my best friend. I mean, like, you know, my heart and soul, and someone I've been through a lot of just ill situations with.
Porter Ray found himself there on tour performing his music about a past filled with heartbreak, only to be heartbroken all over again, and a newly single father. He said it took him about 3 years to find the strength to write about his brother, and has taken him about 3 years to write about Joy.
For a long time, you lose somebody or something up happens in your life, and you're kind of lost, and you're trying to find yourself, and you're questioning who you are, you're questioning what the world is, what it means to you, what's important and what's not. And I finally got to, like, figure all that out again for myself.
I asked Porter Ray how he felt about creating a body of work that is so personal but so public.
One of my strongest characteristics is that I'm myself, and I'm telling my own story, you know, and so that's what's always going to make me unique. At least I hope it will. It'll make me familiar because people can relate. A lot of it's autobiographical, of course, and it's all very personal, but a lot of it too is fun, and it's entertainment as well, and it's creativity, you know what I mean? And so I choose to live with that. And so now I just feel like I'm twice as strong, you know, and twice as quick.
The memory of people Porter Ray has lost still lives in his music, and in other ways too. When the interview was over, I grabbed our photographer to take a headshot, and I stepped away for a minute. When I returned, I saw Porter Ray's son, Aaron. Aaron bears the name of Porter Ray's late brother. He's grandson to Porter Ray's late father, and the son to Porter Ray's late dear friend, Joy. And there he was, sitting in his father's lap, having his picture taken with his dad.
Switch the address, semi-automatics in my mattress, switching up my status, butterfly kisses, eyelashes, holy skylights, time lapses, post-life passes, blunt ashes, blow through Damascus, I flow through the ashes, holding up my glasses, pink robes, a toast to the madness, I rose from the ashes, Muhammad met Cassius, hello. Wildfire through the forest that I chase my dreams, bullets dumping out the Taurus, I'ma take the lead, girls jumping on the tour bus to make a scene, 2018, laser beam, make you scream, last night wouldn't change a thing.
Okay, so I promised you some news at the beginning of the show. Sound Effect first came on the air almost 6 years ago. The show was a dream come true for those of us who have worked on it, being able to share the stories of the people and places of our region with you. But there comes a time where all good things come to an end. Next Saturday, we will be broadcasting our final episode of Sound Effect. We will be celebrating the show with a 2-hour special starting at 10 a.m. The show will be filled with some of the very best stories from the last 214 episodes. There'll be some laughs, there'll be some tears, there'll be a few surprises, and it's our opinion that it'll be some of the very best storytelling we ever made. We are so thankful for the hundreds of people who trusted us with their stories over the years, and for all of you who listened. So again, we hope you celebrate with us. Please join us next Saturday, October 31st. That's Halloween, so it should be easy to remember, for a two-hour final broadcast of Sound Effect starting at 10. Sound Effect is produced by me, Kevin Kniestead, with Jennifer Wing and Posey Gruner. We got help this week from Gabriel Spitzer, Ali Ferguson, Hans Anderson, Kari Plogue, and Parker Miles Blome. Our executive producer is Florangela Davila. Every single episode of Sound Effect is available to go back and listen to anywhere you get your podcasts. We would love a rating and review, and you can also tell your smart speaker to play the podcast Sound Effect. Again, please join us next week for a two-hour special as we say farewell. I'm Kevin Kniestead, and this is KNKX.